that helps with doing big stuff. And then I look, as you get older, you aim a little lower. And I just say, well, yeah, you still might make an impression. Everybody wants to leave something behind them, some impression, some mark upon the world. And then you think, you left a mark on the world. If you just get through it, and a few people remember your name, then you left a mark. You don't have to bend the whole world. I think it's better to just enjoy it. Pay your dues and enjoy it. If you shoot an arrow and it goes real high, hooray for you.
Dream about you. Dream about you.
Welcome to Graduates Anonymous, a podcast where we unpack the enigma of graduate school. Today, we are joined by a fabulous, wonderful guest, AY. Hi, AY.
Hi.
Yeah. Hi. So AY is joining us today. She's completing, currently working on her master's in philosophy. Is that correct, AY?
It is sadly true.
I'm curious, what do you have, like a focus? Do you just know all the philosophy or?
No. Oh God, no, absolutely not.
I imagine that wasn't the case, but you know.
So we brought you on because you were the philosophy expert. So that's kind of not going to work maybe. You don't know
I've
everything.
Known philosophy bros in the day who they state that they know it all.
Precisely. I was just about to say some people believe they know all the philosophy. but I think that there's something incredibly non-ironic about the whole Socratic, I know I'm wise because I know that I know nothing kind
right.
of thing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I don't know. It's not that I don't know nothing. I hate double negatives. It's not that I have no knowledge, but I think there is something to be said for how understanding the levels of complexity within philosophy sort of demands a kind of intellectual humility about what one doesn't know. I don't feel like I have an expertise. I just feel like I really like this and I have this weird opportunity to be able to focus on it.
Yeah.
Totally. More than many people are able to. Yeah. So my work focuses on Black feminist philosophy and political theory.
Mm. Awesome.
Yeah.
Cool. And I'm sure we'll get more into that as we go along.
Yeah.
But usually we start out with just a little recap of our weeks. That can be whatever you think is relevant or interesting or you want to share.
Yeah. What's been up with you?
So
anything new?
So Terrence, what did you have going on this week?
Oh, me. As many of you know, I'm new to the city that I live in, and it's been a hustle just trying to find a job. And then it occurred to me, it doesn't matter. It's a summer job. I can work anything. I can do literally anything. So I am now the newest employee of Bed Bath & Beyond. And
yes.
you're an anonymous. You don't want to give away your location. There's only one Bed Bath & Beyond in the whole world.
Shut up. Don't tell anyone that.
Find you.
I have always had this idea about ever since I was 16 or 17, and I had to seek my own employment. I'd always tried to think about my employment as a opportunity, as a kind of strategic opportunity to say, what need do I have to fulfill in my life right now? Like, what is a basic need that would be helpful for me to be able to meet? So I've worked in many restaurants solely as a way to have access to food, especially when I was traveling and was sort of living on the edge of poverty, if not outright poverty. And you know, that mentality extended into other sort of areas when I was more stable. And I said, well, you know, I'm going to work at this kind of place because I have access to leisure, you know, and working at a bar in part because it was by my house is where I hung out. And so this was another thing that less out of an explicit need for something basic and more of like, well, I just moved and I'll be moving to another apartment here in a week or two. And what better place to work over the summer before I have to quit possibly in the fall than a place that will allow me to furnish my entire apartment for relatively cheap.
You get a like sweet employee discount.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can give
it
to one
so
person.
Jealous.
So I gave it to my mom, who
nice.
Shouts out to my mom
That's
who runs
amazing.
An event planning business in DC. I was like, hey, maybe you, want to take advantage of this discount. I don't know. I don't know what you might use it for. But she's like, I don't shop there. I shop at Michael's. And I was like, okay.
Can you layer the coupons with your employee discount?
You can, in fact, layer the coupons.
What? I know. So you're basically going to be getting like 70% off of everything.
Well, I have to locate coupons first.
Everywhere. I can give you
they
coupons.
They like text me somehow.
Yeah.
I did not sign up for this, but... 50% off bath mats right now.
Oh man!
I didn't even know I needed a bath mat.
Listen, my takeaway number one, having worked one shift at Bed Bath and Beyond, is that we have so many products designed specifically for us to interact with cheese. It is an outright shame. There's like manual cheese graters, electric cheese graters, cheese wheels, cheese tumblers, cheese fondue pots, like cheese forks, cheese salt plates. It's like, all right, we don't have like this many healthcare options. Like, how do we have so many different choices for cheese? In any case,
when you say cheese tumbler, I imagine like one of those giant blow up balls that people put on like pools, but that has cheese in it.
Yeah.
Just kind of roll around and eat cheese at the same time.
I feel like
I don't know if that's accurate, but that's what I'm going to keep in my imagination. But hey, AY, what would you like to share about what's going on in your week?
Does it have to be funny and charming?
No.
No, it could be dull. Okay. It could be morose. It could be very real.
Okay, great. I think that then it would be, it's imperative, I guess, to talk about Nabra Hassanin and Charlena Lyles,
yes.
Two Black women who were killed this week by a world that within which they were never meant to survive.
Yeah.
Nabra Hassanin, I don't know if you have already heard her name, young Black Muslim woman. She was 17, so yeah. Like right on the edge of so much of her life. I was going to say right on the edge of womanhood.
Why did you hesitate to say right on the edge of womanhood?
Mm-hmm.
So why step back from that that statement?
I think because she was 17 years old.
Yeah.
It could also just be that I'm projecting. When I was 17, I was a mess. And I think in a lot of ways, I really wanted to be, and not just wanted to be, I was a child in a lot of ways, and I wasn't in many other ways. And I think that liminal zone is a space of vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
And I just reading the reports of, what was the name of her murderer? I feel as though he should be named.
Yeah.
Darwin Martinez Torres.
Hmm.
And then we have Charlena Lyles in Seattle was killed by a police officer after she called to get help because she was being burgled and she ended up dead.
Yeah.
And she was pregnant as well. Is that
mm-hmm.
correct?
Yeah. Yes. So it's we have many dimensions here of reproductive justice. We have Islamophobia and then of course we have two Black women. And so
May I add mm-hmm. one more name to this, to the sort of sort of brief obit that we're sort of giving and so perhaps some homage, but the, Charmaine Wilson, from Baltimore, is something that I've been paying close attention to. She's a mother who her child's bike was stolen, and she called the police. And this is last week, and she called the police to report having that bike stolen after deciding that like she knew the people who had stolen the bike and was killed by the someone associated with the bike theft. And it's an example of perhaps going in a slightly different direction. So I won't get into it too much, but suffice it to say, it's another sort of tragic loss of life in a situation that involves a community's relationship with the police force.
Forcefully anonymizing the bodies of, like, it's by forcefully anonymizing Black bodies. Mm-hmm. Like, we lose our specificity and our humanity and our value against this backdrop of white supremacy and a body that is rendered just a target in the public sphere and in the private sphere, right? I mean, Charlene Lyles was literally at home.
Yeah.
And so I think part of the power of naming and by putting their names into various archives, right, is I think it respects their lives in ways that literally we're not.
Yeah.
And of course it doesn't bring them back, right? But I do mean that there's something important and valuable. And I think probably a moral imperative of knowing the names of in particular Black women who are killed by white supremacy, often by the police state.
Yeah. And it prevents,
because I mean if we, yeah.
I think it prevents people from being dehumanized and sort of washed into this narrative that's very easily swept under some rug or sort of put onto a back burner, you know, sort of forces you to acknowledge these individuals as human beings, right? And everything sort of comes along.
Precisely.
Yeah.
I mean, we hope anyway.
I was just going to say, I appreciate you going to the place of not charming and cute for your weekly recap, because mine has certainly been filled with, that sort of harrowing news, as well as, you know, with the context of the trial of Geronimo Yanez and being acquitted, but also a lot of phone calls and leaving voicemails to my various elected officials regarding local stuff we've got going on here. So that was just kind of, what I wanted to share. And so if anybody's got some extra time, you can just go to, like, you know, any of the numbers of things that are kind of compile issues for you to be able to contact people in your local area or at the federal level. It's very small, but it seems at least effective on some issues, that when people get thousands and thousands of really upset or politely indignant phone calls about issues they care about, that the officials somehow listen magically. And certainly not on every issue, but at least I feel like I'm doing something, because I can't vote on the thing. Thanks, representative democracy.
I mean, we could have a whole show about the government, and we probably should. But I think that you're going to intro my favorite section next, so I don't want to derail it. What section might that be?
Yeah. That would be. Caller scholarship for AY and anybody who's tuning in and hasn't really listened to before. We used to call this something like Science Corner or something sciencey, but we wanted to open it up to a more diverse range of fields. So I tried to come up with a cute name, and now I'm just embarrassed every time I have to say it. But it's stuck.
Oh, it's so good.
So this article, I was scrolling through trying to find stuff, and I almost went past it, but then I was like, you know what? I know nothing about sewers.
Okay.
So the title of this article is Reducing Sewer Corrosion Through Integrated Urban Water Management by Picard and Sharma, who are the two lead authors, and then their colleagues at the University of Queensland in Australia. And I'll just kind of read a little bit of a blurb that I typed up synthesizing some of their article. So, just as myself, you might not think often of sewers, but I guess they are one of the most critical aspects of infrastructure in modern urban societies. Mm-hmm. And obviously, they're super important for human health. So sewer corrosion, though, is the bane of sewers' existence. And it, I guess, mostly is related to sulfides, which are something science-y. We don't super need to know for understanding this article, but
it's kind of chemical.
It costs billions of dollars around the world to try to deal with all of the sewers kind of slowly deteriorating. And I imagine this is related to the various sort of lead issues in water we've seen across the United States, and I'm sure happens in differently developed countries across the world. But that's a different conversation.
Sure.
So this study, they tried to figure out where the sulfides were coming from, because there were sort of all these potential sources and they were checking them out. And they did a whole bunch of different water samples for 2 years. They did surveys of all the different infrastructure. And then they built a model that kind of explored, okay, if it was coming from this source, how much sulfide would we expect to see? Where would we expect to see it? And then they found that the most likely source for the primary amount of sulfate was from the some kind of sulfide compound that is added when they are processing drinking water.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So basically, it sounds like they put this thing in and it sort of coagulates all of the little particles floating around, or big particles, whatever it is. And then it's easier to filter all of that out and make it clean again for water to be drunk. And so the good news is that it's relatively easy to switch that to a different type of coagulant that does the same job, but wouldn't do all of the eroding. And yeah, so it was this, you know, a Herculean effort by seven some odd scientists, but it seems like this cool kind of insight, both into sewers, which I very rarely think about, and into kind of the ways in which we have these unintended consequences just by using, you know, whatever kind of the status quo is, or not kind of considering the tiny updates that could maybe make our lives a lot easier.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I mean, the sort of takeaway for me is, it's here is an example of us kind of like trying to plug one hole and then sort of two other holes sort of spring up on the other side. And like there's this imperative, obviously, in a civilized world to have clean drinking water, to find ways to more efficiently do that. And we have sort of just recently in our history exited a very sloppy sort of industrial age in this country. And so, you know, the idea that people might be adding a chemical compound, aluminum sulfide, or sulfate rather, to water, like, you know, makes sense. But then to not consider the corrosive effect it has on something that is really sort of essential to maintaining sort of sanitation and public health. I mean, this is really a public health issue, right? And it's saying, like, we solved the problem of drinkable water, but what we have done sort of in turn is that we have started a long-term process of sort of structural damage that maybe it contributes to the sort of the things that you see, like what's going on in Flint, right? Where, I mean, Flint is a great example of the unintended consequences of a particular kind of innovation or a particular kind of industrial progress. And so you have people who are sick and dying as a side effect of that. And these forces are forces that are slow to change. So I feel like this is an article that kind of speaks to that a little bit, at least by my interpretation.
No, certainly. And I think it's, at least with this one, it seems like it's maybe just sort of a slow realization of what the downstream effects were. Because, you know, like as you innovate, you're going to use maybe aluminum sulfate was just the first thing they came across that was, you know, helpful in making drinking water clean. And they just didn't kind of revisit that as you went along. So it sort of speaks to that larger, as we have these, you know, just massive systems that interact with and regulate our lives and make them possible in kind of especially, you know, denser urban areas, but in, you know, super rural areas like where I grew up as well. Things, you know, we rely so heavily on technology, but we kind of need to continually make them better rather than just sort of setting them up and letting them go for all time. But I'm sure there are many, many scientists and grad students and policymakers out there who would sort of raise their hands and say, hey, we're really trying to do that all the time. We really want it. You know, we're not just setting it up and letting it go.
Well, let me ask you this question
about infrastructure.
Yeah. Come on the pod. Let me ask you a philosophical question. So this is an example of, people playing with chemicals, you get what I'm saying. And there are these side effects, right? But what do you think might be, do you think that we're experiencing a kind of social erosion, to make an analogy, that is a byproduct of technology, perhaps, you know, like our relationship with technology? I mean, let's just take this idea and sort of make it more abstract. Do you think that, or what is the nature of the erosion, if you think that it exists, you know, as a function of our increasing reliance on technology as people?
I'm actually going to push back on this.
Yeah, tell me.
I'm deeply skeptical that the technology that we witness and that is salient to us as technology is the source of the social erosion as we envision it.
Yeah.
So for example, I believe it was Aristotle who, it might not have been, I can double check.
It's okay.
But he wrote a letter to one of his friends in which he was like chastising the ancient Egyptians for institutionalizing literacy programs for, I believe, upper middle class boys. Because he thought that teaching children how to read would be detrimental to their capacity to memorize, in particular to like memorize epic poetry, to memorize the history of their people. Because like for him, this new technology of writing things down meant that you didn't have to develop a strong memory. And lo and behold, thousands of years later, we're still having this argument of like the way people are using technology these days is like negatively affecting their cognitive capacities. But that's always in reference to entrenched ways of being and doing.
Yeah.
And so I think that without further interrogation of why it is we value the particular things we value, I mean, like, look at newspapers. Like, people were up in arms about reading newspapers in public because they thought it made people antisocial. And so I think that there's something about technology, or rather what gets read as technology, right? Because we don't see printing presses.
As technology,
Exactly. Like, people don't go up in arms about printing presses anymore. And so I think, like, we that question, I think, only makes sense within the context of, like, long history. And so I just, I mean, people who wanted to be antisocial in the 1960s just stayed at home. And I don't think that this is making... I don't buy it. I don't think that my phone is making me antisocial when it's simultaneously connecting me to relationships literally all around the world that I would have no other way of maintaining.
I think it also, the question sort of assumes that the technologies we create are apolitical or asocial, and that they aren't the very byproducts of a relational process or, you know, social needs or desires. And so I think that insofar as technology means anything, it's probably the reverse direction, in that sort of the social, cultural, structural norms are the types of things that are driving technology. And I think, like AY said, it's sort of, you know, it probably has very similar effects. It just looks like a different thing. So,
I'm not even sure if it has like similar effects. Like, one of the things that I'm, I guess, I think you're absolutely right that it has to be the case that, do you remember that Amazon or Microsoft who launched an Android, a bot on Twitter that like very quickly became very racist?
I don't know.
Do you remember
probably
that?
I actually,
scientists of the world.
I don't know that I read about this.
Yeah.
Yeah, so like it was programmed to learn conversation skills or something like that based on what people were saying to it and what it was learning from Twitter.
Yeah.
And Microsoft alleges that it was the target of a focused prank to like teach 4chan? The bot or something like that. Yeah. To teach the bot like really racist things. But I don't know. I mean, even photography itself, right, is calibrated for light skin. And so, yeah, like the actual technology itself is imbricated within, is constructed within a deeply, fundamentally, inextricably political world.
Right. Right.
Right. I mean, that if the political currents sort of continue historically, then you might have similar sort of implications of technology, or just that it just, you know, magnifies or highlights certain facets of the goodness or badness of the political social structure. But especially, you know, in the last 250 years in sort of the inundation of capitalism, it's a very particular form of mostly what we call mendacious artifacts. One of my favorite professors taught me that term, which
that's a great term.
Yeah, it's basically like things that are created that purport to have a certain service, or that they will do something for you, and you might even be sort of the one creating it, but that they fail in achieving that, or at least doing it sort of in an effective or long-term way. So they're lying to you, which I just love it. So it's sort of part of that idea that the reason that capital creates things, including technology, is to produce more capital, more money, rather than actual goodness or effectiveness of the thing that it's creating, in this case, technology. The point isn't the actual product, it's the money that it will create. So it doesn't really matter if it's a cheap thing that dies in a very short amount of time, as long as the consumers are purchasing it and it has that effect downstream. So anyway, that's another tirade.
No, but I mean, I think this is the nature of the show, but this actually is something I was thinking about in at Bed Bath & Beyond to kind of bring it full circle, where I have been. First off, I appreciate the responses, because I mostly ask that question as a kind of like agent provocateur, like how can I, like I think this is a question that I've heard a lot, and it's something I've thought a lot about as someone who's a proponent of technology or an advocate of technology in sort of limited ways. But I've thought a lot about this in the last 24, 48 hours of walking around into this place that is really like a palace to this kind of like the decadence, the sort of planned obsolescence that is inherent in a capitalist system, you know?
Bed Bath and Beyond?
No. Everything is essential.
I know.
But, you know, I think
all of those cheese graters.
But, you know, it makes you think of like how many of these products are marketed to like particular demographics, groups of people. I think most commonly, like, I feel like there's a lot of products that I feel like this is marketed towards the elderly, because it says you can do this thing with half the effort. It'll save you time and da-da-da. It's for you. It's to make your life better. But in actuality, its only real purpose is to sell you something. The job really ends at you being sold, and all of the intentionality and all of the goodwill, it only extends to the end of that 30-second commercial, and then it's over. Once you've been convinced to step into the store, step into that world, and travel through a space that's been explicitly designed to convince you to spend more of your money, it's all part of this sort of clockwork, right? The point of which is to kind of like, you know, churn you in and sort of squeeze out the dollars that it can from you and spit you back out so that you can go make more dollars, so that you can be fed right back into it. And It's entirely circular. But this is
I'm glad we got from the sewers one kind of shit to another kind of shit.
Hey, that's I like that. I like that, bringing it all together with a little bow there.
So I think that's a good potentially transition kind of into our main topic today. AY's got some awesome knowledge to share with us. Kind of in this context of Pride and the police and recent movements that are trying to sort of synergize and understanding the intersections between justice and Pride and and so AY, take it away.
I should start by saying that I'm a total fraud. I don't actually know very much about policing as an institution, except for the ways in which it bothers me.
Sure.
Awesome. Good place to start.
I just take issue with various forms of violence on principle. But I don't study police abolition in particular. I couldn't give you a coherent theory of policing within the state. It's something that I noticed, and I think that people don't talk about it in particularly interesting or productive ways.
Yeah.
But that could also mean that I'm not talking about it in productive ways. So, you know, hashtag don't be a hypocrite. Is how I'm going to preface this.
Well, should we, before we get into it in depth, I think it's worth mentioning that, you know, this episode will release on Friday, June 23rd. And it's the weekend before Pride, which typically takes place in the last Saturday of the month. And I think for context, we should talk a little bit about like the history of Pride. We're referring to the sort of LGBTQ event that happens every year and has been happening every year since 1970. after the infamous Stonewall riots of 69. And I think perhaps, do you think that it would be useful? Actually, I'll pose the question. Do you think it would be useful to kind of talk a little bit about the history of the event? Because I think that kind of is deeply intertwined with this question, because I mean, it really does sort of spur from conflict between a police state effectively in New York and around the country and the LGBTQ community, which also simultaneously is dealing with sort of structural disagreements about the role of like trans people and people of different racial backgrounds. So, I mean, is history important here, and do we want to do it first, or should we just talk
history
about
it? History is never important, Terrence. You always exist in the current moment, and nothing that happened before ever has any effect on today.
That is literally my life philosophy.
I don't get why you're so worried about the past when it's literally past and over.
You know what? You're right. Like, tomorrow's a better day, you know?
Exactly. But
I don't want to be like a bigoted person of color, you know what I mean?
To humor those people who do believe in history. I think it'd be good to have a bit of a brief overview for people who maybe aren't kind of in this space a lot, or who just aren't familiar by virtue of whatever.
But only a little bit. We don't really
only a little.
Only
they can Google.
Here. I'll provide the cliff notes insofar as I understand them, and then perhaps then I'll sort of take a backseat a little bit as a student of history and a lover of all things. so this is the 60s. So this is at the time that you have the civil rights movement. This is the time that you have the sort of counterculture free love movement, a.k.a. the hippies. But you also have a gay movement a gay and lesbian movement that is sort of growing across the country. Initially, these sort of silent protests. You had several homophile groups that popped up, the name for the groups of the time that were sort of pro sort of equal sexual rights or equal representation, rather. There was this tradition at the time of police raids. They were commonplace all across the country, where effectively, particularly during prohibition, under the pretense of breaking up events for the illegal distribution of booze or prostitution, They mostly were the militant arm of a government that saw these different deviant social groups, subgroups, as being counterproductive to like the American exceptionalism, this idea that, that we live in this great, magnificent country and the law of the land should be a law that is applied to all people insofar as we understand it from Washington, D.C. and so these raids were used often against groups like the Black Panther Party, in addition to being sort of liberally applied to members of the LGBTQ community. And this came to a head in Stonewall, the Stonewall Inn, a mafia-owned bar. This is a place that was a sort of common space for Latino, Black, and white homosexual men. And there were also some of the New York Butch who would hang out as well, but to a lesser degree. And it was effectively a raid that went bad and turned into this protest. And many people say that the catalyst is, I think her name is Storm, possibly. But she was half Black, half white, lesbian woman who had been struck by the police by a baton and then sort of reportedly shouts out to the crowd, like, why are you just standing there? And then the riots sort of began proper. There's a fire, and then they continue over the course of a couple of days. And those riots are what we commemorate when we do these pride marches, because initially pride was about visibility and about having a conversation about issues important to the LGBTQ community. Now it's more about, I think, visibility and capitalism. But the question about police, I think, is an interesting one, because the movement in many ways was sparked by conflict between this community and the police. And so that's the brief history lesson about pride. And if I've missed something, please fill in the blanks for me.
So I'm not a historian, and I don't, and I have no objections, but probably for bad reasons. I don't work well with chronology, and that is the issue. But it sounds, I mean, I think that like you hit the main points, right? Yeah. That part, I mean, I've seen so many in particular, like white cis gay men saying to me, like, I'm a queer Black woman. They don't say to me that I'm a queer Black woman. I was saying that I am a queer Black woman in conversation.
I was like, that is an interesting statement to make.
No, I'm a queer Black woman, and I end up a lot in conversations with cis white gay men who say things like, you know, pride is about inclusion, and keeping the cops out of pride means that we're excluding people from pride, and no one should be excluded from pride. And I'm like,
right.
You have no idea how you got to where you are.
Yeah.
Like, you literally are like feasting off of the fruits of the labor of primarily like Black and brown, queer and trans folks.
Yeah.
And you're talking some nonsense about inclusion. Like, pride was only about inclusion when corporate interests became involved. And I think like a very much a liberal rights framework. I can't remember where, I think I heard it from another podcast actually. They were saying that ever since marriage equality got passed in the United States, donations to LGBTQ organizations have been going down.
Oh, interesting.
Due to the perception that like, you know, the bulk of the struggle for the LGBTQ community is over.
Yeah.
But that's nonsensical, right? Yeah, like, we still have, like, trans women are still some of the most vulnerable groups within the LGBTQ community and as a whole, right? Like, I think that you see constantly, like, fragile cis women, and I'm a cis woman, so I'm saying this with my eyes wide open, who want to claim that like cis women deserve special spaces because of the violence that cis women face, when trans women are in fact oftentimes significantly more vulnerable, especially in the public sphere. Trans women, you know, so I'm frustrated by this deliberate historical amnesia.
Yeah.
And a refusal to contend with how the gay rights movement has really been a liberal capitalist rights movement for upper middle class white gay men who somehow co-opted what was at first like a like a clash with state violence.
Right. I mean, and
that.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Well, that I don't know as much about kind of the No Justice, No Pride initiative, but from my understanding and how I kind of synthesize all of these horrible things that police do is that, you know, they are an agent of the state and their job mm-hmm. is to protect property and capital. And,
exactly.
And so that description of the way that people sort of don't have this memory for the history of pride and the way that justice is integral to that and sort of even this sort of ongoing clash with police entities, you know, sort of forged the movement in the modern sort of state, as it were. That totally resonates with kind of how I understand police action in general.
Yeah.
But can you speak more to kind of what the No Justice, No Pride sort of what that means to you, or what do you feel like it means, kind of how it's manifesting right now?
I mean, I think that it's important to say that their goals, I mean, they have a list of demands, and part of me wants to just read them so that I don't like speak for this group. But there are a few. And so and this is sort of localized in Washington, D.C. in reference to Capitol Pride. So when you hear Capitol Pride, it's talking about the
Pride. It's O-L, not A-L.
Yes. So Capitol Pride will honor the legacy of Pride and the trans women of color who inspired it by ensuring that trans women of color play a central role in decision-making processes. Number two, Capitol Pride will take a strong position against state violence and end its endorsement of MPD or any other law enforcement agency to march in the Pride parade. Three, Capitol Pride will address its neglect of indigenous, Muslim, and Two-Spirit communities. Four, Capitol Pride will bar corporate entities that inflict harm on historically marginalized LGBTQ2S people from participation in Pride events. Five, Capitol Pride will immediately sever all ties with Wells Fargo and defense contractors and donate any and all funds for them to local community-based organizations that support for queer, trans, and two-spirit communities. And finally, Capitol Pride will commit to restructuring, replacing, and expanding its board of directors to represent and center the leadership of historically marginalized communities. So these are some pretty clear objectives, and they actually sound very similar to civil rights objectives in the past. Divest from harmful corporate entities, create spaces that place people who are historically erased from the conversation or marginalized into positions where their voices matter and they are in positions of leadership. And also sort of restructure the organization, the people who make the decisions in the organization at a sort of larger level, at a almost corporate level, organizational, institutional level, rather, diversify those individuals so that even those decisions are sort of better representing the group. And that's what they're about. That's what the No Justice, No Pride is about, for those who have not heard of it. And
so it sort of it stemmed from this DC group, and then it's hopefully kind of
Gesundheit hype.
Moving outward, and other groups are adopting kind of similar platforms or kind of tenets, I guess is the right word. Or does it seem like it's that's meeting resistance with other Pride organizations? Do you have a sense for that?
Something that AY, I think maybe you were going to speak on too. I mostly wanted to jump in and sort of say, well, these are what the exact demands are.
Terrence with the facts.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm not involved with any kind of Pride planning because I am just frustrated and repulsed by so much of it.
Sure.
And this year I've been sort of, I plan to, if I'm out while there are Pride events, I will probably go. But this year, I don't think I'm going to be going out of my way to attend Pride unless there are explicit, at least Pride in my city, except for like the explicit protest dimensions of it.
Yeah.
I don't think that drinking mimosas on a patio at 1:30 p.m. is a form of protest.
Pretty radical. I think that, there's like, orange juice and it's mixing with champagne.
Like, I'm just not. And don't get me wrong, I think that there's something, I think that there's something important and valuable about just being able to, I keep using the term public sphere because I think about it a lot. Yeah. I think there's something important and valuable about just being able to, like, go out. You know, like, for all of the trans people of color who are living in spaces where they can't, where state forces are trying to prevent them from being out in public by denying their access to, like, using the bathroom.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, being able to just exist in a set and a series of really mundane activities out of the house is probably a litmus test for a lot of things.
Yeah.
But I don't think that that is in and of itself I don't think that for the majority of people engaging in brunch on Pride, that's a particularly political act for them.
Yeah.
And hey, you know, not every sip of water that the subaltern takes has to be radical and revolutionary.
Yeah, I think that's an idea that I come to a lot of kind of, you know, people talk about, like, the personal and the political. But for me, those terms, I often think of, like, this is, I have these political ideas and the things that I sort of long-term goals that I, you know, would like for myself to be working toward, or our social, you know, larger society to be working toward. But at the same time, like, on this day, if I'm super low spoons, I don't know if y'all are familiar with that term, but like, if I just don't have what it takes to get up and do the fight that day, like, that's, you know, you can't always be doing it. And so it's kind of a balance. But I think on the whole, like, if your vision, if, like, you aren't aware that there is something beyond drinking mimosas, then that's where it becomes kind of limiting.
Well, let me ask you this question, though. I mean, I agree, and I also kind of disagree a little bit, in the sense that, I mean, it seems like the intention of something like Pride has really kind of gotten away from, it would be as if, like, sort of city hall meetings turned into, like, you know, like, nightclub events where it's like, your congressman's going to show up at 10 p.m. It's like, well, that's not what we engage with. Like, that's what the point of civil discourse is.
It'd be more interesting, but less effective.
But, you know, the point of it's, I think it's sort of, there's a different idea that I've had about, and I've had this conversation about, increasingly more specific language around different things, what other people call being politically correct or whatever it is, or what have you. The idea that it is valuable for us to sort of further drill down and describe and sort of name and have a discourse about the different kinds of experiences, there's value to sort of saying that there's a class of people or a group of people that we can refer to as trans that have an experience that is different from someone who is gay or straight or lesbian or bi. Ultimately the thing that you want to do with all of this is to get to a point where demographics are not determining your identity primarily, and that you can be sort of person, you can be broadly American or like a citizen of, you know, Baltimore or Idaho or wherever. Right. And so there's something that kind of, it does serve the, but I think AY's point is really important here about who it serves, but it does sort of serve this goal, which is it's creating the space where being yourself is, like, normal, and it's, like, not questioned, and it's not, like, you don't have to take up the mantle. Just the fact that you can go out and celebrate, and you can look out into a crowd and go, I'm not sure who is gay and who is straight or whatever, or that it even matters, but I know that we're all sort of here as people who agree that, like, equality for these groups of people is important to us. And the way that we express that is by, like, enjoying ourselves and celebrating. And so I think that there is value to getting to a point in a movement where people cannot have to consider the movement as being one of the end goals of said movement, right? I mean, like, as someone who cares a lot about racial justice and equality and equanimity, you know, the idea is that if I choose to have children, which this, I'm not so naive that I believe this will happily.
Oh, no. What happened to him? Hello?
What? What? Hello?
Oh, no.
Can you hear me?
Cut out for a while.
Did I?
Yeah.
We can hear you now. Yeah.
Oh, man. Well,
you were saying something about like getting to a point where you can enjoy yourself. And then the next thing we heard is, I'm not so naive that I can have children.
Well, no, it's okay because on my side, the recording persists because we're recording from my computer. So I'll just make a note to jump in here and take well, the point that I'm making, though, and I was being very sort of long winded about it. But the to sort of catch up to speed. And there's nothing wrong with like joining in that celebration, but I think that the No Justice, No Pride movement is sort of saying, no, we haven't reached those goals yet. And so I think that it's that's just how I view the event as someone who is, you know, cis and hetero. Which
I was just about to ask, are you a straight person? Because you describe Pride like a straight person, Terrence.
Oh, I mean,
yeah, I disagree with you completely on so many things you just said there.
Fantastic. Okay, well, what do you disagree with?
Tell me. So I think one of the first things that comes to mind is I disagree that the aim of Pride is to get to a point where we don't have to think about like the aim of justice is to get to a point where we don't have to think about identities anymore. Mm-hmm. I think that's just like categorically false. I think for me, and I think part of what was so radical and important about Pride, about the Stonewall riots, like in the moment that you describe, for example, when Storm looks into the crowd, is this true? Is it apocryphal? I don't know.
Yeah.
But when she says, are you just going to stand there? That is a demand that one take very seriously, their identity in relation to Storms, in relation to those around you.
Yeah.
In fact, I think that our relations to the state don't make sense without taking our identity seriously. Even if you want to contend that perhaps racial identity should not be a primary factor, or rather how one is racialized should not be a primary factor in determining particular life outcomes, I don't know that you can make sense of why that should be the case without taking racial identity seriously, without taking seriously the various identity positions within the state. Right. The monopoly that the police have on being able to deploy guns with impunity only makes sense because of the identity position of the police officer. Mm. Right. They're not just teaching you how to use particular tools. Right. You see emblazoned on the side of cop cars to serve and protect.
That's
a particular set of role specific responsibilities that are supposed to be integrated into the actual perception of the police officer when they move around the world, to be able to make distinctions between who's being served, who's being protected, who's being incarcerated, who's being chased down. And if anything, I think a maximally just world would actually make space for us to take our identities and to deploy them and the perspective that it gives us in particular just ways, rather than having to move our identities out of the way we cognize the world.
No, I mean, and I actually really appreciate that. And I think that it is an important challenge to what I'm talking about, because what I have ostensibly laid out is this idea of, well, this this kind of determinism that comes as a result of some category of identity insofar as it exists in society now, this idea that, you know, the lesson that I learn about what it's like to be a marginalized person in America sort of colors, no pun intended, the sort of my entire experience as a person in every sort of space that I'm in. And I think that the, you know, one way that I've like sort of internalized, chewed on, and sort of like thought about that is that like the world that I would like to live in is a world in which like that kind of experience isn't the kind of experience. And maybe I'm not being careful enough with my language to sort of suggest that like identity should matter. And I don't think that I intend to say that, or that like retaining a sense of one's identity is not, ceases to become important. I think that it challenges me to clarify more and to sort of think more about that position so that I'm not making that statement, and that what the statement that I'm actually making is sort of more of a desire to be able to embrace or have that identity and to have it be something that doesn't prevent you from access to equality or access to opportunity or access to justice. And so demographics don't preclude humanity, you know what I'm saying? And so I think that that's kind of where the idea for me really originates from. But I as a challenge to that point, I really appreciate it, because I think it's something I have to be careful about when I think and talk about this stuff, so that I don't, like, I don't know, sort of step over my own self, because I have a stake in this also, you know, and like, mm-hmm. don't want to sort of erase my own history and experience and
precisely.
Identity, right? But it's navigating that can be challenging. And I think it's important for me as a male cis person of color. I think it's important for me to be wrong about the way the conclusions that I draw sometimes, because I think people have this perception of, well, when the black person says something about his experience as being black, then it is inextricably correct, right? Like, we can sort of mm-hmm. take it as like, well,
and shockingly, multiple people of the same identity can have different experiences.
Yeah, exactly.
And so they necessarily will contradict each other
from
time to time.
No, but it's important. This is why community is so important to me, because when mm-hmm. I talk to other people who have adjacent or similar experiences to me, and I hear their interpretation of those experiences, it really does force you to step outside of your own like head and skin and be less what's the word I'm looking for? Like egocentric in one's worldview, you know what I'm saying? But you disagreed on several points. And so I think that.
I think there were a lot of things that you said that I've sort of, I guess, like lost now. But I think that was like one of my biggest contentions. And I guess like you said something about being able to enjoy yourself. What had you said?
Oh yeah.
So being able to enjoy yourself.
Effectively, like people getting a movement sort of getting to a point where like the movement is no longer necessary is a sort of inherent goal of any movement, is to sort of say, well, we're fighting this fight so that one day we don't have to fight anymore. And so I sort of, and perhaps part of the folly is sort of making a false analogy between the gay rights movement and the sort of civil rights movement, insofar as I understand them, in sort of modern contemporary life. One mm-hmm. I've examined to a far greater degree than the other. So there are several assumptions mm-hmm. I think I make about the gay rights movement. But this idea that pride ultimately ends with it being a party because protest is no longer necessary.
Yeah, I think that like that's a really interesting. Because I mean, I guess my question then would be, do you take it that the civil rights movement, is ended in a party, or that it's no longer necessary, or that like times just changed? Because my question then would be, oh, ow, I just hit my knee on my own desk. I'm getting old.
Getting passionate.
Because it's not. So my question then would be, if there is anybody who is able to party at Pride, who is that person, or who are those people?
Yeah.
And why?
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Is it the case that they're partying because they are positioned in ways when they're being deliberately, willfully ignorant of the vulnerability of people around them and the ways in which they're partying causes harm or comes out of a kind of harm? So are they partying because they're insisting on not noticing the political reality that gives rise to a bunch of white cis gay men partying in the streets for a month, right? and being able to present that party as a form of, you know, dramatic political activity simultaneous with the ongoing murders of trans, primarily Black women.
Is it
that they're able to party because they don't care? Because if that's the case, then I think that, like, the party isn't telling us what we think it's telling us.
No, that's
the party. Yeah, the party is not an indication of some kind of political progress. Rather, it's an indication of how within the LGBTQ community, whiteness can still function to protect many white LGBTQ people in ways that being racialized, right, stands in direct opposition to.
Yeah.
Well, so like potentially like the way you're framing it, it seems like it's either a loss of solidarity, like that your experience and my experience are intrinsically linked, or it's representative of the fact that it was never actually cemented within the movement for everyone,
right?
That you were necessarily fighting for your brothers and sisters. Regardless of the gains that you yourself made because of differences of identitarian factors. The other thing that it makes me think of the kind of the ways that in kind of the tail end of the 60s and beginning of the 70s with the civil rights movement and the ways that it moved into sort of more broad-based material factors that would affect the lives of Black folks. And that was then when people just cracked the fuck down on the whole movement and started killing people and in large numbers. And then that's when the major sort of leaders were taken out. And I wonder if there's, you know, as a resident communist, I wonder, you know, about those intersections of socioeconomic status. And I imagine that a lot of the brunchers who are out there with their mimosas are relatively comfortable economically, and that doesn't also play a role. That their sort of economic stability is able to not only make them feel that the relatively minor gains of the movement of a whole are sort of complete and they're fine, but it's also inured them to the plights of others and made them not have to consider that. Certainly that's not the only factor, but
sure.
Just as someone who commonly kind of brings it back to that material reality, that's what kind of it comes up for me.
Well, I mean, so for the listener, there was a brief period where our signals cut out and I found myself talking to nobody for a moment. But I think this is one of the things I was saying in that sort of 30-second window where you guys couldn't hear me, which was precisely the latter thing, which is I wonder if, like, the reason I say it ends in a party is, like, I wonder if the point was never really after a certain sort of transition. I mean, you have the death of Harvey Milk. After the death of Harvey Milk, you get the rainbow flag, and the rainbow flag is created initially sort of simultaneously based off of Somewhere Over the Rainbow and the sort of global, like, world peace or global peace flag that had different stripes of colors for different skin tones. They've taken this idea and then it sort of circulated, and this is sort of in San Francisco. So the Castro district creates this sort of icon that is this sort of celebration of the different flavors of this experience. Right. And I think that there was a certain point that you see the flag itself changed twice due to these forces that we're talking about, because the demand for these flags sort of increased and they're trying to sell these flags more. And so the symbolism of the rainbow flag was so easily malleable that it really flexed to fit to these capitalistic demands, these sort of like industrial demands, which was, well, we don't have any more turquoise fabric, so now the pride flag doesn't have turquoise anymore, and we don't have any more of this lavender fabric, so now it's going to be indigo and violet. And so you see sort of the how easily this message is subverted by these other intentions. But me sort of entertaining this thought experiment that says, what if the pride movement, as we know it now, at whatever point it deviated and started to become what it is now, it stopped representing those people who were initially sort of so important in its genesis, right? And that was really the larger point that I was trying to make, is that it ends in a party because the people who ultimately sort of took the reins of pride insofar as we know it, had goals that were ultimately self-serving. And like the need for an actual kind of protest reemerges as individuals who we have considered to be represented by the umbrella LGBTQ sort of designation wake up to the fact that they're not being represented by this group. And that this group doesn't represent their fundamental
interests.
That sort
of necessarily means that the Marsha P. Johnsons, the Storms, have been sort of pushed out.
Yeah.
And that, like, yeah, but that doesn't mean that that's not still their movement to reclaim. And
Absolutely.
Which I think that's sort of what the No Justice, No Pride, that's from their tenets. It seems like that's what they're attempting to do.
Yeah. I think this has been a really interesting discussion, but should we push forward into another topic, or do we live here? How do we feel about this at this point
well,
in the episode?
Perhaps in the interest of our own material realities, things we've got to do to be graduate students and be little humans in the world and the rest of our day, maybe we should move on. But I would love to have AY on because I'm super intrigued by the self-care is warfare notion, and I'd love to hear more about that. But we could do that on another day.
Okay.
But yeah, thanks for that convo. So let's see. We usually finish up by having some recommendations. It can be something political. It can be a music thing. It could be a podcast or an activity. I think one time I recommend people go on a walk. So anything that you think our listeners who could kind of be anybody, but in theory are prospective grad students or current grad students, recent grad students, what might they enjoy? Terrence, do you want to start it out?
Sure. So I guess in the spirit of this discussion, which has, I guess, largely been around pride in America, and we didn't even really talk about police in great depth, which is something that I have a lot to say about. But again, another episode. If you've never seen the film Paris is Burning by Jenny Livingston, directed by Jenny Livingston, it's a documentary.
I was going to recommend that.
and it stars some people that you may be familiar with from this sort of Harlem era drag scene that was the balls of New York City, these sort of extravagant events. So you have people like Dorian Corey and LaBeija and Extravaganza, and you have Willie Ninja, who became Madonna's choreographer. You have all these people who were really influential figures in this community who are big, important parts of this subculture. And Paris is Burning is really a documentary that takes you inside of the world of these events and introduces you to several people and sort of takes you through some of the things that some of the questions they're asking themselves and some of the hardships they deal with in their lives. It's a very powerful, it's a very, very, very powerful film. And Dorian Corey ends the film with a quote, and I don't want to give it up because it just like, it lingers with you for so long. At least it lingered with me for so long. But it's fantastic. And if you're going to challenge yourself to think about pride in an intersectional way, and you're going to challenge yourself to think about pride in a way that sort of steps outside of the sort of temptation to indulge in something that we rail against often here, which is capitalism, I would say Paris is Burning is a really interesting way to connect to some of these stories.
AY, I'll give you a little bit more time to think of a second rec.
I'm ready. So,
you're ready. Okay.
Yeah, you go though.
Okay, I will go. So I just finished. I've been trying to read more fiction because I feel like I like it better than watching TV fiction. So I just finished The Dispossessed by Ursula Le Guin, and she's part of the kind of echelon of feminist science fiction writers of the sort of latter half of the 1900s. And this book sort of imagines two planets that are kind of interlocked. They are each other's moons. And one of them is sort of the epitome of capitalism, and one of them is like a very extreme socialism that is sort of centralized. Everyone's name is assigned by at random by a computer. No one really owns anything. It's all collective. And it's these two very extremes. And one person from the socialist planet, which is actually kind of a satellite. It emerged after people protested and wanted a different world on the capitalist planet. And they left and created a new society. One person from this new society actually goes to the old one. And it kind of mixes everything up for both places and really questions the idea of what both extremes have to offer, but also have limitations. And it's really beautiful. Le Guin's an amazing author. And so I enjoyed it a lot. Yep.
Awesome.
How about you, AY? What's on your list?
I would say two recommendations. The first one would be This Bridge Called My Back, by Sheree Moraga and Gloria Anzaldúa. It's
on my bedside table right now.
Oh, perfect. Yeah. So you should pick it up. It's a great book. It's an anthology of women of color writers, a lot of queer women of color, talking about a lot of things. And I think it's a classic of feminist theory, I think for good reason. And my second recommendation would be Sister Outsider by Audre Lorde. I call it my Bible. I think that I have this like practice where whenever I like feel lost in the world, I just open to a page in Sister Outsider. And it just contains always, every time I find something in there that grounds me or recenters me or reminds me to just take 10 deep breaths. And I think everything that Audre Lorde has ever written is true and valuable.
Yeah.
And so that would be my recommendation. Read lots and lots of queer women of color who have been theorizing about these things for decades longer than we've even known how to read.
Yeah. Yeah.
I guess I'll add one more that this made me thought of, which is not really a recommendation per se, but for anybody who's currently affiliated with a institution of higher education and who hasn't discovered interlibrary loans or sometimes there are more local loaning sort of consortiums. And that's like, I don't buy books because I can't afford it, and B, don't see a reason to do so when I can get it for a loan. So basically, like, our library where I attend school is pretty small, and so oftentimes a book that I want won't be available, but then that you just kind of hop on, and each school does it differently, but you can hop on and request a book be shipped from somewhere else. Usually it's like the closest school, so it's not incurring huge shipping costs, etc., for the school, but or climate impact type of costs as well. Sure. But I'm super into that. It's like I evangelize about libraries because they're awesome.
I think that the librarians of the world appreciate you for saying that.
Awesome. So without further ado, we'll let everybody get on with their day. We'll just say you can check out our website, gradanon.fireside.fm. You can send us an email, gradanonmail@gmail.com. We're on Twitter @gradanon, and you've found us somehow, but we can be found on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, any podcatcher in the world, hopefully. we love you all, and we hope that you're taking care of yourselves and doing what you need to do.
Yeah, thanks for being on the show, AY, and we hopefully we can bring you back on to chat some more about some of these other topics, because I enjoyed talking to you, and I think that as is the case with at least one other guest now, I feel like the conversation ended before we even got to some of the things that I really wanted to chat about. But this is the nature of doing a podcast. So thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. I had a great time.
That's wonderful. I love the podcast and all the friends I make by doing it now. All right, we out.
Bye.
Bye.
Take it to the Serengeti. My rhymes is heavy, like the mind of Sister Betty.